I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. From streetcar extensions to raises in minimum wage, and even a plan for light rail, there were some big decisions made by Kansas City voters yesterday, who also dealt with Missouri's new photo ID law at the ballot. Today we'll review what got passed, what didn't, and how the results could affect you. But first, we'll explore the challenges confronting African Americans, both as doctors and as patients. We speak with one black doctor about his experience in medical school and the disparity he sees in treatments for African American patients. Later, Bill Brownlee brings us this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Medical school at Duke University was tough enough for Dr. Damon Tweedy, but it became all the tougher one day when, as he arrived for class, a professor mistook Damon, who was black, for a custodian come to change a light bulb. That's a roundabout way of saying that race has long been at the forefront of Dr. Tweedy's career. When he first arrived at Duke, he felt underprepared among the privileged graduates of Ivy League schools, and he worried about being seen as a product of affirmative action. Later, there were the issues that arose as he dealt with both black and white patients. Today, Dr. Tweedy is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University's Medical Center and staff physician at the Durham Veteran Affairs Medical Center. He's also the author of a 2015 New York Times bestseller, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. He's in town today to speak at events sponsored by the Center for Practical Bioethics and another one at the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. And Dr. Tweedy, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Good morning.
I hate to break this to you, but you're not going to have much time for lunch between this interview and your first speaking engagement this afternoon.
Yeah, it's a busy day.
It's a busy day. I want to take you back to your first year as a Duke medical student. You're about a month into classes, and you're just starting to gain some confidence about your prospects there. And then an incident occurred that set you back pretty dramatically. What happened?
Yeah, so this was, again, about a month into that first year of school. We have a break between classes, and so I go out to use the restroom.
Yeah.
Come back in the lecture hall, and as I walk back in the lecture hall, the professor confronts me at the entrance to the lecture hall and says, "Are you here to fix the lights?" And, you know, first I'm thinking there's someone else that he's thinking about, talking about. You know, there's someone behind me or beside me, but there wasn't. It was just me and him. And then he says, "Well, you know, I talked about this last week. I called you. Why haven't you done this?" So he really had in his mind that I was this other person than who I actually was. And the exchange sort of went on, and I said, "No, I'm not here for that reason." And he said, "Well, then why are you here?" So it was this idea that I didn't belong in some way. And I think that's a reflection of how Duke at the time, and many medical schools, Duke is just one, is emblematic of a larger sort of, you know, problem here, was in this system of just sort of beginning to recruit African-American students to school. And there was sort of this old versus new kind of conflict. And so the tension was there. Some professors were resistant to that. And so this was sort of like an outgrowth of that.
I didn't get any sense from the story that you tell in the book, Black Man in a White Coat, that he was the least bit embarrassed.
No, I think it was just, again, I think it was the old versus new kind of thing. And I think in his mind, that was sort of his image of an African-American male, you know, coming to his anywhere in his orbit. That was the purpose in some ways. And so, you know, it was really like you look around and I'm trying to find other explanations as to why he might have seen me this way other than race. I'm not someone who just automatically jumps to that conclusion, but ultimately there was nothing else I could point to. And I was already at Duke in a place and I felt out of place. Wasn't sure I belonged. And this was sort of like, well, if the professor, I don't feel I belong, professor doesn't feel I belong, maybe I don't. And so that was sort of this sort of coming, you know, I had to sort of come to grips. Is this a point where I'm going to make it or not? And that's something I think is often many African-American students do struggle with in these institutions when they come to places like a Duke or somewhere like that. And so for me, I decided that I had to show I belong, prove to myself and to him. And I found myself studying around the clock for the next several weeks, literally like 2-3 hours of sleep a night. Ended up getting one of the best grades in the class. But at the end of the class, you meet with the professor to sort of do the sign out. And even then, there was still this awkward exchange because it seemed as if he was surprised. He couldn't believe that I would get like one of the second or third highest grade in the class on an exam. And it was a really sort of like a sense of disbelief and really awkwardness. And so it just left you with this feeling that no matter how you wanted to be like everyone else and just be a student to fit in, there'd always be people who would see you and you'd have to sort of and make inferences about you based on just how you look. And you have to sort of find a way to cope with that and deal with that. And so that's one of the themes that sort of emanates in the story.
His name was Dr. Gale. Did you ever speak to him about it?
No, I never. So Duke's a huge place. And so after that initial last meeting after the end of the course, we never saw each other again. He subsequently, passed away some years later.
I was going to say, you know, for you, what comes clear in this telling of your story is that you wanted to fit in. Who wouldn't in a situation like that? And it's so difficult, not only because of your skin color, but because of where you went to college as opposed to the Ivy Leaguers all around you. Mm-hmm. And you have guys like Dr. Gale asking you to change the light bulbs. Right. What kind of setback was that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was just that reminder. It's like that, just like it hits you over the, you know, a ton of bricks kind of thing. It's a reminder that
you're not like everybody
else. You're different. You have to make sense of it. So that was one piece of it. Is that was like the personal side. But then in the classroom, you're learning about all the different health problems that are somehow more African Americans are more affected by over and over again. So every disease we would learn about, you know, high blood pressure, cancer, diabetes, they would always end up saying that it was more common among blacks or black people did worse. And so, again, you're sitting there as a black student and all its attention is sort of being put on black people as having a, you know, being a risk factor of being sick. And so, again, you're having to sort of process that information as well. And as I got further in that first year, I developed health problems myself. And so it was like, gee, what I'm learning about, maybe there is something to this. So it's like, again, trying to make sense of your place being a black person in this medical world. That's that where you're on the outside.
You have a phrase for it, doctor. It's being black can be bad for your health. Those are your words.
Yeah.
And given the demographic, the stats when it comes to disease after disease, tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, as you know, in that first year of med school, you learn about different diseases. You always learn about how it affects the body. But then there's always this issue where it comes, they call it demographics. Who's affected more? Men versus women, young versus old. And the way that race and ethnicity was discussed in 1996 was black versus white. Now, we know that a quarter of the population is excluded when you sort of do it that way. But that was the way it was always discussed, black versus white. And it seemed like black people always came out worse. And so that was the narrative. You could sort of see it coming during in the lectures. I get this sort of sick feeling.
You dreaded the demographic information because you knew it'd be one more example of you having to stand out a little bit.
Yeah, and you look around, you wonder what classmates are thinking about it. Are they processing it? What are their thoughts? Do they think it's all the fault of black people? Do they think it's, you know, who knows what they think? And so that was a thought that I was sort of in my mind as well. And you left with this idea that race is somehow a risk factor for being sick, but there was no explanation as to why these things were happening. And so that was also the big missing piece as we sat in the lectures and learned about these diseases.
You know, your parents didn't go to college. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so my parents are late 70s now. So they grew up in the era when there was segregation in the truest sense of the word. My dad grew up in Southern Virginia on a farm, 8 of 10 kids, very like in a three-bedroom house. You look back, you're thinking, how do they all manage on a farm? And so he ended up going to the military. That was sort of the way to get out of the world that he was in. Otherwise, he would sort of be stuck at a foundry kind of job and went in the military and then eventually moved to Washington, D.C. Ended up working at a grocery store, I'm not sure what the local popular grocery stores are here, but sort of like he worked in the meat department of a grocery store, and that was his job. And my mom grew up in the inner city of D.C., raised by a single mother. And she ended up getting a job, like a sort of administrative kind of job in the federal government level. So together they carved out a working class sort of life. But we lived in an all African-American community. Again, this idea, theme of segregation, 100% African-American community, went to segregated schools up until high school, tested into a program. But anyway, so I was in this. So it was almost this theme of sort of being separate and being apart. And so when it came time to choose for colleges, I went to my state college in Maryland, University of Maryland, the Baltimore campus. And so, you know, it was a great program, actually, that I was in. It was a program that was encouraging minority students to get into the science field and the engineering and medicine and things of that sort. So many of our students did well and went to med schools like Duke and Johns Hopkins and places like that, you know, University of Virginia. And so when I got to Duke, though, it was like, gee, everybody here is not only have they gone to these sort of Ivy League type schools or to Duke, but their parents are all sort of like, you know, doctors and lawyers and business people. And they sort of had like this sort of cultural capitalist, a term that's used a lot. And I felt many ways out of place. It was like, and just trying to find my way in that world was difficult.
Where did your ambition come from, your drive to go to medical school and your interest in ultimately going in that direction?
I think it started actually, so in eighth grade, I was in a middle school that was 98% African-American, probably by today's standards might be called low-performing school. Many of the students there were not on track to graduate high school, let alone go to college. And so in some settings like that, you know, it's difficult for the teachers for sure, but also sometimes the teachers don't often invest as well in the students and they have low expectations. And that's sort of a self-fulfilling kind of thing. But I was always good at math, and I had an eighth grade teacher who took it upon herself to really try and get me into this magnet program. And so I tested into a science and technology magnet program, which was something I was never thought I would do, but got into this program. And then I was around students from different backgrounds a little bit. And that really was the first inkling that maybe science, I had something with science and math and I could do well. And I got a chance to do an internship and met an African-American doctor for the first time in my life. I was probably 17, 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And that was when I really thought, well, medicine might be something I could really do.
You know, you were entering a world that was completely foreign to your parents. Mm-hmm. How did that go down?
With my parents, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, they were very happy for me. I mean, there was no sort of sense of like, you shouldn't do this. They were fully behind me doing it. I have an older brother who was actually the first person in our family to attend college. So he had, in some ways, had laid the foundation for me, you know, to sort of say, this is something that you can do. You know, a lot of times in the world that we live in, people might take for granted the idea of going to college as a regular student is no big deal. But in the world that I grew up in, that was a very big deal, particularly as an African-American male. If you didn't play football or basketball or run track, you weren't going to college. And so for my older brother to be someone who had done that was a tremendous example for me in my own home.
Now, at what point during your time at Duke, Doctor, did you begin to think, maybe for the first time, that you could compete with these kids and that you, in fact, could become a doctor because that's what you wanted to do?
I think that class where the professor asked me to fix the lights, and then when I ended up getting the second highest grade on the final exam of the course, I'm thinking, wow, there are 100 students in this class, and I got the second highest grade. I can't believe I did this sort of thing. And I was like, wow, maybe there is something. Maybe I really can do this. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the beginning of me thinking. So that's why that moment was so important. It was like a point where you can sort of, like if I had done poorly in that course, maybe I would have been one of the students who just sort of said, this isn't for me. Because mm-hmm. I'd already sort of felt I wasn't welcome. But that sort of was able to prove to myself and to the institution around that I really did belong.
What did your other friends, people of color who were in your class, say about that incident that you had there with Dr. Gale? What did they say about you being asked to change the light bulb?
It's a mixed thing because, you know, in some ways, it's just one example of things that students in my experience, some worse than mine. So in some ways, we use humor to kind of cope with it because it's the kind of thing where you almost say, well, this is the way things are. It sucks. We have to kind of do, what do you do? You know, so, you know, because if you go the route of sort of quote unquote complaining, the administration, the people might not understand what you're upset about. They may think that you're just making something up. You're misinterpreting it, all those sorts of things. And so I was like, well, so you'd be sort of just try to joke about it. Well, you know, at least he didn't ask me to, you know, take the garbage out. You know, you have to sort of try and make light of it in a way, which is not, which is unfortunate, but it's sort of the way in which we cope with it. And for me, it was that coping piece, but then also the idea of just sort of moving forward. But I would say that having those students there who could understand that experience was really helpful because that was the first year that Duke had really just increased the numbers of African-American students there, in particular, the medical school. So having some students there who could really instantly understand my experience and my reaction to it was helpful.
How many were there?
Yeah, so, you know, in previous years, I would say we're talking out of a class of 100, there may be four or five students, so, you know, small numbers. But that class, the numbers doubled, so it was about, you know, 10 or 12 students.
Yeah,
and that was that was a big deal. It was a big difference.
Dr. Damon Tweedy is my guest. He's the author of a book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. I should point out he'll be delivering the 23rd annual Rosemary Flanagan Lecture on Race and Medical Education, Narrative Reflections of a Black Doctor. This is one of the big events each year for the Center for Practical Bioethics. The event will be at 7:15 tonight at St. Joseph Medical Center. More information, practicalbioethics.org. He also speaks at 1 this afternoon. That was my reference to he won't have much time to eat lunch at the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. That's at 1750 Independence Avenue. He'll be talking about race, bioethics, and medical education. You're invited to that as well. You're also invited to give us a call right here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You write, Doctor, that you were pretty naive about the world as you went off to Duke and about hospitals and about medicine. How so?
Well, my parents, blue-collar background, very much so, they had working-class jobs and they had health insurance. And so there was this sort of seamless, and they had good health insurance in their cases. So it was sort of this seamless thing where you think that almost everyone who works and has a job has health insurance. That was sort of this kind of really naive world that I entered into. And when you go to med school, they don't really talk about that. And that was, at least at the time that I attended, that wasn't the kind of discussion we were having. So you only really encountered this once you got into the world and started to see patients. So yeah. As you get further along in medical school, you start to see patients in different settings. And there was one particular clinic I talk about as a chapter in a book devoted to going to this clinic that's about an hour east of the campus. It's in a rural part of North Carolina. The town was literally all black. It was half black, half white. And we were in this clinic staffed by medical students and a doctor from Duke. It was like one Saturday a month. It wasn't really a clinic. It was like a one-room house. The patients, they were all black in this case. None of them had health insurance. But all of them had jobs. And I was like, this is real disconnect. I'm like, really? How does this work? Because it just wasn't something I sort of understood. You know, everyone has these misconceptions and stereotypes and perceptions. And this is part of why it's hard to really talk about healthcare and healthcare reform, because people go into with information that's sort of, I'd say, in some ways, limited. Right. And so I had no idea. So I had this sort of misconception in my own mind that, well, if someone is unemployed, you know, that's why they don't have health insurance. And you make your own sort of negative, in some cases, perceptions about that. But here, these people are all sort of following the quote unquote rules, if you will, right? They were working jobs, full time jobs, they were married, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But still, they were without health insurance. They were being faced with real problems that were very treatable, but they could not address because of this animal of not having health insurance. So there's one woman, for instance, in a story that I talk about, who has a condition called fibroids, which is it can affect women and where they have heavy bleeding and the uterus it gets enlarged. It's like a benign tumor, but it's very treatable. She also had high blood pressure. Again, very treatable conditions. But we were in a setting where she didn't have health insurance. And we were like, well, how are we going to get her medicines for this? We can't refer anywhere to get this her fibroids treated because she doesn't have health insurance. No one's going to take her. And I remember the supervisor saying that day, well, the only way she's going to get treatment for this problem is if it gets worse, so much so that she has to go to an emergency room, and then she'll get treatment. So this idea of someone having to get worse before they could get treatment just made no sense at all to me. And that's what I mean by being naive.
You worked on in a hospital in a tough neighborhood at one point doing your internship or whatever, and you saw the notation on a chart, GSW.
Oh, right.
Gunshot wound. You didn't know what that was either.
I'm thinking Golden State Warriors, you know, basketball, right? So I had no idea. You think maybe I'd learn from watching some of the TV shows, but even then I didn't pick it up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw plenty of it there.
I'm also wondering about you find yourself doing multiple things at once, looking down at some of your African-American mm-hmm. patients while at the same time relating to them in some very direct ways. That sounds like a wicked juggling act, and I'm wondering how you managed to navigate that.
So I'm very honest and candid in the book. I mean, I think one of our problems we have is that there's a sense that everyone has biases. Everyone has things that are not ideal. And it's how do you address them and work through them and not let that compromise someone's care. And that's the real challenge as a doctor. So in this particular, so often many of the patients I would see would be very similar to my family members in terms of their socioeconomic background. I mean, this is my uncle, this is my cousin. It would sort of have that thing as I saw this particular person. But at the same time, I was becoming part of this other world. So I'd come from that one world, but then I was becoming part of this sort of white-coated world.
How'd you navigate? How'd you figure out how to weave in between the
it's
two?
It's a juggling act. I mean, so, you know, the doctors mostly are overwhelmingly white and Asian, many higher socioeconomic backgrounds. And so I was becoming part of these two worlds, and at times it was really tough. I felt like I didn't belong in either world at some points. I was like, I had a foot in this one world and a foot in this other world, but didn't really have 2 feet in either world. And I was sort of struggling to sort of navigate that. And so I think it was really difficult as I was in the training period when I wasn't as sure about myself and my own sort of clinical competence. It was actually really difficult. But as I've gotten further along, the further along you get and the more assured you are of yourself, the easier it becomes. But it was very difficult during that training period I write about in the book.
Did you find yourself ever looking down on some of your patients, given like, look at me, you had accomplished so much. Mm-hmm. It would only be natural, I guess, to some extent to say, to think that at times.
Sure. You're like, man, if you could just... You know, why are you making this bad decision? Why don't you just do this sort of thing? Even though a part of you knows it's a lot more complicated than that, there's a part of you that still feels that way, certainly. And so I would struggle with that, but also would struggle with the idea sometimes of patients not knowing what to make of me as well. It could kind of go both ways. You know, the patients might look at me, some they might look at me in a really positive way, and some maybe not so much. So it was always, because a lot of times it's, patients may think, well, where does your allegiance lie, sort of thing. And you sort of you have to pick a side. And it was sort of that kind of feeling sometimes. So it was, and so there's this term, it's an old term called double consciousness. It's this idea, it's called double consciousness. It's this idea of being an African-American and sort of having to navigate the two worlds of white and black, and always seeing yourself and in relation to those two worlds and how those two worlds are constantly judging you. And it's a difficult sort of I call it psychological baggage in a way.
I bet when you first began, when you'd walk in the room, you'd knock on the door and open mm-hmm. the door, you're looking at their eyes and you're wondering what that patient is thinking as they confront an mm-hmm. African-American doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's certainly in the South, you see patients who are, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s. You think about the history of in North Carolina, other parts of the South. You wonder, sometimes you wonder what side they were on history. Like, what side were they on in the 60s, right, or the 50s? And so there's those kind of thoughts that enter your mind. And then sometimes the patients make it obvious. They'll look at you, and so even if I'm not thinking about it, again, they'll make me think about it, because I've had cases where patients don't want me to close the door in the room because I'm perceived as a threat, even though I have a white coat. So it's like, so even if I don't think about it, it's being, you know, they're thinking about it.
One white patient looked at you and said, I don't want to be treated by no country doctor.
Yeah. Well, no, I actually said he didn't want inward doctor. It was even more.
Okay.
Yeah, it was even more direct than that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's go to some phone calls. We just lost one. Frank was calling and Frank just hung up. I was trying to get him. Okay. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with Dr. Damon Tweedy. Black Man in a White Coat is his new book. We'll also talk about last night's Kansas City election results with KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, the media critics explored why female TV news anchors don't make it to retirement on air like their male counterparts, and how digital disruption has changed how work is done and job satisfaction in so many newsrooms. You can find that conversation at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we talk with new teachers about urban education on both sides of the state line. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour I'm talking with Dr. Damon Tweedy. He's the author of Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. You know, one example you give in the book, Doctor, came during your student days when you were treating a black teenager who at that particular moment was hysterical and having a late stage miscarriage. You were taking her history when your supervisor barreled in and barked, "When's the last time you smoked crack?" Addressing the patient, obviously. How did you react to that? Interesting moment.
Yeah, I was taken aback, obviously. So, you know, as a med student, you're pretty naive in some ways, again, about interviewing patients. You're not as skilled, clearly, as a supervisor as far as getting information from people you see. In that particular instance, so the young woman, she was sort of denying everything, the questions I was asking her about drug use. So I thought about it, but then she denied it. And then the supervisor comes in a very much more demonstrative way and just sort of accusatory way, almost like that you see those shows on TV where the officer comes in and says, you know, you are guilty of this and sort of just, you know, please confess now kind of thing. And so it was that kind of a scene, it felt like an episode of Law and Order or something like that.
Was the doctor able to cut through the BS and get her to talk about what was really going on?
Yes, in a way she was. And so it's a mixed kind of story, because in some ways she got the information, but it's like, gee, the way she went about it, it's hard to imagine that ever happening in a different setting with a different type of patient. Like, you know, I make the commentary about seeing treating students, who, you know, for instance, Duke students who are use drugs and are more affluent, but someone ever come at them in that certain way. So I'm kind of mixed about it. She got the information. It turns out that it was ultimately, you know, too late, and it wasn't anything that could be done to save the fetus or the growing baby. So,
you know, a nurse later suggested that the young woman, she came in later and said the young woman should have her tubes tied because, quote, "I don't think people like her should be allowed to get pregnant again." Would you expect the same reaction to a white teenager in a similar situation?
Well, see, a couple of points here. So that was a time that wasn't too far removed from when crack was sort of like, you know, we talk about opiates now. It was crack then, and crack was very much associated with African American people in particular. And so there were actually some states in South Carolina, for instance, one state below us that actually enacted a policy where they would screen people for drugs without them being known. If they were found to have used drugs, they would sort of involuntarily voluntarily keep them locked up. And there's a lot of talk about people being sterilized. But my thought was, wow, this person's only 19 years old. There's a lot of life left for this person. Is this the right way to go about this and to talk so openly, disdainfully about someone who's so young? And so as I learned more about this person, because it's part of me, I had some of those same thoughts myself. So that's the conflicting part of it. It wasn't like I was strictly just judging that nurse, because I felt some of those same things myself. But then as you get to know this woman, the young person and her story and the really horrific abuse that she experienced growing up, it sort of made you think, and the lack of treatment that she got. Again, this issue about people not having access to treatment, no types of drug treatment or anything. And you start to think, well, in the right setting, could this person reconstitute their lives and move forward? And so you mix, right? So, you know, sterilization is a very potentially permanent thing, right? And so I was like, gee, this is like, why are we going to this versus the idea about treating this person in a different way?
How effectively, in your experience, do doctors and nurses sort of screen their own feelings and biases about their patients as they go about their daily rounds?
Medicine is such a busy life. I mean, you can easily just get caught up in the vortex. I mean, you're in the hospital, you're in the emergency room. I work in those settings, and you see so many people one after another. Who has time to sort of sit back and think? You're just trying to stay above water.
Yeah.
I mean, but the healthcare system the way it is, I mean, it's often very difficult to do that. There's more effort now to sort of get people earlier in their stages trained to begin to think about these issues, like when they're in medical school and early in their specialty training. Because once you get further out into the world, it's much more difficult to sort of start reflecting in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's been a shift in terms of trying to get people to think more about these issues at an earlier stage. I think it's important, very important, because there's all sorts of ways in which these biases can come up, and we're not even aware that we have them. And it's true for everyone. It's not just sometimes the problem is that we say this is a white versus black thing, but this happens across all different groups in all different directions. And race is just one aspect. There's class, there's religion, there's all sorts of ways in which bias sort of takes place.
You know, you wrote in the New York Times last year that the dearth of black doctors is a factor in the poor health statistics for African Americans. What's the connection?
Well, one is that it's striking that the low numbers of African Americans in medicine. There was a report that came out. So just to give you a little bit of statistical data. So, you know, the U.S. population is 13% African American about. In most of the cities where these many medical schools we think about are located, particularly in the East Coast and Midwest, large African American populations. Like, for instance, Durham is 40% African American. You know, Baltimore is 2/3 African American. So me as a black doctor, I'd be in a clinic where half the patients are black. I'll be the only African-American doctor available. And in many of the patients were actually wanted to see an African-American provider, particularly when talking about things like primary care issues or mental health issues, things that are much more sort of where the relationship is more important than, say, treating a broken finger, you know, where it's much more a relationship-based treatment, it can be really important. And so the idea of having someone who might be able to relate to their experiences or connect can be really important. Just to give you a quick example, there's an issue with diet. So like diet and blood pressure. So that's something I talk about in the book a lot, about my own struggles, being diagnosed with high blood pressure as a medical student, understanding the role of culture and diet and how my own resistance to eating better was in some ways based on my own, you know, racial and cultural background. Understanding that and being able to work through that, that's a really important issue for patients, many African-American patients as well. I mean, hypertension is a notorious problem among African-Americans, but a lot of times you'll see patients being labeled as not compliant or non-compliant because their meds are prescribed and maybe they're taking them, maybe they're not. But sometimes I don't know if doctors are taking an extra step to say, well, what could be getting in the way of this person doing what we want them to do? And it could be something like a cultural thing. Like the food is very cultural, right? And this idea of certain foods being associated with blacks or with whites or whatever is a real issue for patients that I don't think often a doctor who hasn't experienced that may be able to sort of be attuned to. So I've had several patients where that issue's come up. We've been able to really make significant progress. And it's really based on my own sort of cultural, racial background, being able to connect with them in that way.
And so if more doctors were black, you think more African Americans might want to connect with the healthcare system more often?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's like every, I mean, certainly not. I don't think the goal should be every black person should see a black doctor. I don't think that at all. But I think that I think there's certainly the option for choice, and there's certain people that is a really important issue. And so the problem now is that for people where it is an important issue, the market doesn't even allow the choice for that to happen. And so that's where I think the concern is. It's just about having the option for that. That's often not there.
Tell us about one of your patients, doctor, a man named Keith, who shows up in sweatpants and a camouflage jacket and whose interests include guns, motorcycles, pickup trucks, and race cars. You eventually developed a good rapport with him. who's Keith?
Yeah, so this kind of speaks to the flip side. Like, how do we connect with people who are different than us, right? Because this world is not set up where we're going to have, you know, every doctor that's going to match the patients in terms of the race and background. We're going to have to interact with people who are very different than us.
Keith's white.
And, right, so in Keith's case, Keith's a white guy. He had been in or served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was coming back from those experiences and trying to adjust to life. It's often a very difficult adjustment for a young veteran. So this is in a veteran clinic where I was seeing him. And, you know, I was looking through his record. You mentioned those things about guns and motorcycles and hunting and all those. These are all things that are not part of my experience or interest. In some ways, I may even have biases against him. This is the idea about bias. And so I found myself making judgments about him without even really knowing anything about him. Like, I'm seeing him as something more than just not the individual, but as his representation of other things. And that's what happens to people all the time. And so as I did that at first, and he saw me, and he had the same kind of reaction, like, this is not going to work. And so initially we were talking, and it's very much, I ask a short question, one-word answer, short question, one-word answer. It's not going anywhere. But then I realize, I start to ask him about his family. You know, family is a common theme that connects all of us in some way. And so he reveals a small detail about his father, how they shoot pool together. And it was a detail that also was something that connected me to my own dad. And so it was the first point in which I could see him as an individual beyond all the stereotypes. And I mentioned this to him. He sort of, you could see the connection in his own eye. And then from that point forward, we started having a full conversation in a doctor-patient way.
And you both recognized it.
Yes, it's instant connection. And from that point forward, I followed him for years, and I saw him through his sort of readjustment to life here, and you know, back home. He ended up going back to school, to college. He got married, engaged, had kids. So it was this idea of, like, how can we connect with people who are different than us and make it, and really get past our biases? And that was sort of the way in which I think that's a lesson that all doctors and patients can take.
That's interesting. You know, much of your journey, doctor, struck me as a lonely one. Am I right about that?
At times you just is that constant.
You're on your own. You're fighting your own battles.
At times it felt that way. Some of that, I would say, though, is, and this is something that's often a case with many minority students throughout the, you know, this is just one school, but this, in some ways, my experience is representative of students all over. So it's this idea of, like, how I'm by myself, and how do I navigate these experiences that are different than others? So it was very much that. But I think what I've tried to do, and one of my goals of writing the book was to try and make it more open to people and make people realize this is a real issue that's out there and that students are struggling with this, and how do we move forward from this?
Huh. You strike me as a doctor who likes to be able to spend time with his patients. Are you able to do that these days with all the pressure to move through patients as efficiently as possible? It's a pressure you've already mentioned here this morning. How are you navigating that?
It's hard. And I think, I mean, it really hurts the healthcare system in so many ways. I mean, there's this pressure to sort of measure by volume, how many people you can see. And that's how, in a lot of ways, incentives are based. I mean, so I'm in psychiatry, and even in psychiatry, that's the model. And I think that's just not the way we should move forward. I'm in a fortunate place now where I'm able to take more time with patients. And so there's still some of that pressure, but it's not nearly as bad as it has been at different times.
Dr. Twitty, a few months ago, you wrote a column in the Washington Post about this country's fear of mental illness, and you focused on a fascinating new book by Ron Powers,
yes,
who had two sons diagnosed with schizophrenia. You expressed a lot of admiration for Ron, who's been a guest on this program before. I'm wondering why.
So he's out from this part of the country, isn't he? From this neck of the woods, kind of, sort of?
Not Kansas City, but
okay.
Yeah.
See, I'm revealing my East Coast bias. I'm sorry.
If it's not East Coast, it's somewhere out there.
I'm really
somewhere.
Sorry about that, everybody.
Yeah.
I read the book, and I was just really – what he does is he sort of he talks about his two sons. And the thing, one of the problems, again, we have with mental illness, which is even in some ways worse than the general medical system, is this idea of us versus them, this idea of people with mental illness being different than us in some way fundamentally. And I think our inability to sort of connect with them as – they're our sisters, brothers, uncles, you know, really impedes our way of treating them. And so what he does in the story is show how normal his sons were and how normal their lives were, but then how they got derailed by mental illness. And so I talk in my review about being a med student in a state psychiatric hospital and looking at patients in that sort of distanced way.
You had a hard time with it, as anybody would.
And absolutely hating it in that way. But then I had a friend who experienced a severe mental breakdown, someone I knew from the before, and sort of saw how mental illness changed, disrupted his life, and it really kind of gave me a different perspective. And I think that's what he tries to achieve in his book. So I think it's a really important thing, that lesson for us as readers.
Dr. Damon Tweedy is the author of Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. He speaks, delivers the 23rd annual Rosemary Flanagan Lecture this evening, 7:15 tonight at St. Joseph Medical Center. More information, practicalbioethics.org. He speaks at 1 o'clock this afternoon, just an hour from now, at the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences, 1750 Independence Avenue. I think that program will be live streamed as well on Twitter. Doctor, what a pleasure to have you here. Good luck with everything, and thanks for the good conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You bet. Coming up, a conversation about last night's Kansas City elections and the results and what they mean. Tuesday night's election produced some significant results for the future of Kansas City's streetcar system. Question one passed, and that means expanding the system may have just gotten a whole lot tougher. Here to talk about this is KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. And Lisa, welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
Unexpected results last night. What does the measure do that passed question one, and what does this mean?
So the measure actually prohibits any city officials from planning, for preparing for any construction, for spending any money and any penny on planning for streetcar expansion until they gain voter support from the entire city. So it needs to go on a citywide ballot before they can do that. And additionally, it establishes a penalty on city officials for noncompliance.
That sounds pretty extreme.
It streetcar proponents are saying it is pretty extreme. They say that it effectively kind of stops expansion in its tracks, so to speak.
We should be real clear here. Question one was proposed by streetcar opponents, right? People who did not want the system to expand.
Right, right. So it was brought to the city by a citizen initiative petition. So they gathered enough signatures to get this on the ballot.
I guess the big question here in Kansas City today, then, what does this mean for current expansion efforts? I get a sense City Hall is still trying to navigate and grapple with this and sort through it. Do we know a clear answer to that at this point?
A clear answer, I would say no. But technically, as you know, late last week, a smaller election, a mail-in election to establish, a special taxing district for a southbound expansion to UMKC passed. So, when that passed, a political subdivision was created there. So that technically can't be affected by a petition initiative. So that process can continue. But at some point down the line, the city involvement is needed. City planning is needed. And so that is really the part that's up in the air.
What are the city's options at this point, Lisa? You hear already talk about a legal battle coming up.
So the city now has to decide whether the ordinance that is now passed kind of passes legal muster. I mentioned earlier the penalty that is tacked onto city officials for any planning. There are some that say that is problematic legally. So they'll refer it to their law department. They'll see whether they can take any steps or whether they would even enact the ordinance.
Okay. Did city officials do enough to get the word out about what the potential impact of question one might be?
Well, we should say turnout was extremely low for this election, as it is for, August special elections. In Jackson County, it was about 11%. In Clay and Platte counties, even lower, closer to 8% turnout. So there is some criticism going around on social media that the city and city officials didn't do enough to get the word out, didn't do enough to explain what people were voting on.
Is it fair to say that there was more support for question one north of the river, where the streetcar doesn't exist right now?
I think it's extremely fair to say that. Question one had actually, albeit narrowly, it did fail in Jackson County part of Kansas City. In Platte and Clay County, however, it did pass by wider margins. So I think in the end, maybe 850 votes separated yes from no's.
Wow. So a close election.
Close election.
Let's move on to question two last night. This was the latest plan from Clay Chastain. Clay says now, Lisa, this is the end of his activism in Kansas City. We've heard this before. Is it really?
We have heard him before. I spoke to him last night in a very sober conversation. He seemed genuinely defeated, genuinely confused as to why people wouldn't support this plan, which he thought was a really reasonable plan that would be great for the city. Let's hear it straight from Clay.
People may just be tired of Clay Chastain, and I can certainly understand that. I mean, I'm tired of Clay Chastain at times because this has gone on so long, and people may need another champion or another individual to champion the cause. I may be holding the issue back. It's possible. So that's why I think I need to step aside and perhaps somebody else, you know, fresh face with a fresh vision for our transit system could get something approved by the voters. I say my era is as an activist in Kansas City is gone with the wind, it looks like, and I need to accept that, respect the voters, and go on to another moral cause.
But again, we've heard that before, Lisa.
We've heard that before.
Let's move on to the final question here, the minimum wage the question that was on the ballot last night. What does this one mean? The minimum wage, people here supported raising the minimum wage despite a state law that's passed that says Kansas City can't do that.
Right. So this question passed, by wide margins across the city. And what remains is whether the city can actually enact it or not. I think if the city chooses not to enact it because state law prohibits them from it, then they're going to see a lawsuit come from the petitioners. The other option would be for the city to take to go to court to fight the state on that law. So that I think either way, that one ends in a legal battle.
And just briefly, grassroots groups now have started gathering signatures for a statewide petition to put an increase to the minimum wage on the ballot, right?
Right. So they'll have to collect about 100,000 signatures statewide so that everyone in Missouri can vote on a minimum wage hike. And certainly, you know, in regards to that, a win in Kansas City does boost that, at least symbolically.
That's KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. Nice job, Lisa. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is here with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
I need the lights turned down, Steve, because things are about to get sultry in here.
Okay, we're going to talk about Bloodstone, and this band is Kansas City born and raised, right?
They sure are. Bloodstone is one of the most successful bands ever to come from Kansas City. Uh-huh. We're about to hear their biggest song, which is a big hit from 1973 called Natural High.
Here's Bloodstone. That's Bloodstone, Natural High, a hit from 1973. And Bill, it's amazing to think they're still around after all these years.
People still want to hear those songs.
Were they big back in the day?
This song made them a national sensation. They appeared on Soul Train, the summer this song hit.
And I think this song peaked at what, number 10 on the Billboard charts?
On the pop charts, right. On the R&B charts, it was an even bigger smash. But, you know, it's funny to listen to this, you know, 40-some years later because the production is so spare and so sparse. And, you know, music doesn't sound like that today. They'd never allow a thin production like this to even get close to a radio station today.
Well, the band experienced a big loss back in 2014. What was that?
Yeah, Charles Love, the founder of the band and its primary artistic force, passed away. And, you know, he was getting up there. But with so many R&B bands from the 60s and 70s, whether it's Earth, Wind & Fire, The Temptations, they just keep going. The older guys leave and replacements come in, guys who may not be the original thing, but they have the energy and they have the voices. So,
have they found somebody who can hit those high notes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They found somebody, eh?
That's right.
But where can listeners hear Bloodstone this weekend?
The Negro Leagues Baseball Museum is having its annual hot dog festival in the Jazz District on Saturday. And Bloodstone is on so you can eat your hot dogs while you listen to Bloodstone, After Seven, and Zap. R&B and funk bands, so it'll be a great time.
Does Bloodstone still perform around town outside of this event?
They play things like this once or twice a year, but they're on the road. They've got a big show coming up in Las Vegas later this month.
No kidding. That's KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee talking about Bloodstone. Thanks very much, Bill.
So glad to be here.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, we hear what it's like for new teachers in urban school districts. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.